Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Here's a question that we have all been thinking about. Should we feel safe getting together with family this holiday season? Now, it seems that throughout this pandemic, the messaging has been, it depends. Wear a mask, then you can feel safe. Get vaccinated, you can feel safe. Now get boosted, get your kids vaccinated, and then we'll be able to put this behind us. But we haven't yet put this behind us. Now it's Tuesday, so a little later we will take your calls for Ask the Doctors. And that number is 1-800-423-8255. But first, we want to consider this idea. Do we have a problem with messaging? And is that why we can't get a handle on this thing? Joining us now to help answer those questions, Robert Blendon. He is an emeritus professor of health policy and political analysis at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. Professor Blendon, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just ask you, do we have a messaging problem? Is that why we can't get a handle on this thing?
So first, and I think your listeners are aware of this, the scientific recommendations change over time. And for many of the public, they're used to science having a conclusion and it stays for years. And as this has evolved, whether or not it's safe or not, do you need a booster or not, what you have to do, the advice has changed. And so that makes it more difficult on messaging. But the biggest issue that has occurred, and it has never occurred before in an epidemic that we can find in the United States, people have decided they're going to make some judgments here based on their political views in the United States. And so Democrats are very receptive to what scientists have to say, even if they change messages and require people to close businesses and mandate vaccines. And Republicans have really taken a position that this is an affront to individualism. And their trust of scientific advice is much lower. Their fear of the epidemic is much lower. Their willingness to have their lives changed is much lower. And for listeners, just to help you, we often just keep talking about the nation as a whole. But what turns out geographically, people often live together in the same political environment. And so the news will cover something in New York City and Los Angeles, this is mandated, or people believe this. And in reality, in Texas or Florida or Oklahoma, they don't believe that at all.
All right. So there's I'm going to stop you there just because there's a lot to what you already said. And I want to be able to break down two pieces that I hear in there. One is scientific messaging, our scientific understanding isn't set in stone. It's changing. And then the other is the politics of this. I want to start with the scientific piece because I understand that, you know, if we decide, for example, that the planets all revolve around the sun, we then don't say, you know, therefore you have to change your behavior right now. There's no social contract really in that. That's something that we hold true
but
as a scientific
also,
reality all along.
Exactly with your point, you don't expect the scientists in 90 days to change their views.
That's right. But we are in a case here, Professor Blendon, where we are asking people to make a social compact based on current scientific messaging and understanding. And I wonder if you can talk about how that is complicated then by the fact that our understanding of the science keeps changing. Should we, I can't believe I'm asking you this, but should we be asking for less if we know there's a good chance the science is going to change? Do you understand my question?
So I think that it's important to know that I believe when this finally winds out, we need something like a 9/11 commission where we really ask some very hard questions about how we handle this and prevent this. And one of those questions is going to be, how do you interact with the American public that are not used to scientific recommendations changing very frequently? And I don't have an answer for that, But that has had an impact on some number of people of saying, well, they're giving me advice now, but it could change. So why should I do anything? And that is a real problem. And then the second issue has to do with the fact that the political polarization has come around about this question. Is this an individual decision that I should be making about myself, my children, my family, or is this some broad community decision? And that has really made this very difficult to deal with, and it affects your thinking about the risk here. So what takes you back is that when you look at how afraid are you about COVID, Republicans say, I am much less concerned about this epidemic and disease than Democrats do. Well, that's impossible. We've never had a Republican view of polio or smallpox or Democratic view. But if I'm not that worried, then it's going to affect my feeling about closing businesses, my children having to get required. So we are receiving scientific information based on our own views about what people should do and make a decision.
So we have data that underscores that that's where we are. NPR ran an analysis, released some information earlier this week that did show that people were dying from COVID at higher rates if they lived in counties that had gone heavily for Donald Trump in the last election. So we know there is a correlation there. I guess my next question to you, since this is your area of expertise, that's where we are. So I'm less worried about how we got there and more what is the messaging that gets us out of that place and back into a sense of shared interdependence and shared perspective on the moment we're in.
So the important thing to really be honest with everyone, people have taken a position on this over a year or longer. It's hard to change those views. We've gotten past, I don't know what it is or for that. So it'll be hard. What we do know about areas that are more resistant to taking steps is that they have a deep distrust of federal, national government, East Coast scientists. They believe there are other agendas involved. So if you were trying to message, you would try very hard to have more non-government people, clinicians who are not located in Washington or the coast, but are in Texas and Oklahoma and the Middle West and talking from Mayo's and Baylor about these issues. You would try to depoliticize this by this is not a problem of the federal government. This is a problem that people face in their lives. So you would try to make the messengers very different. And when I turn on the news in the morning, even though we've had these discussions, it amazes me how many of the news stories are all by four Washington experts telling you what you should be doing. So I would very much shift the locus of the messengers, etc. And it's very hard. People have said over and over, I am not going to take this vaccine in many of these communities. And moving them has to be that they're worried about the problem. And what recent polls just showed is that a share of the unvaccinated have gotten worried about the new variant. And they're saying they're willing to take the vaccine. So the message is, focus on threats to you, your community, families, and the messenger cannot be federal officials for people who are suspicious.
There is our prescription. Robert Blendon, he's an emeritus professor of health policy and political analysis at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. Professor Blendon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before the break, we spoke with Professor Robert Blendon about the messaging around the coronavirus pandemic and how we get everyone on the same page to find our way out of this. But looking at the raw numbers here in Massachusetts, it seems like we're headed back into it. More than 1,100 confirmed cases over the weekend, bringing the test positivity rate close to 5%, which is more than double the level that we saw just a month ago. We are still hovering just above 70% fully vaccinated. So, Omicron. It's on our minds, as are testing, boosters, hospitals, kids' vaccinations? What's on your mind? Call us because it's time for Ask the Doctors. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. With us this week, Dr. Michael Hirsch, Medical Director of the Department of Public Health in Worcester and Director of Pediatric Trauma at UMass Memorial Health, and Todd Ellerin, Director of Infectious Diseases at South Shore Health. Dr. Hirsch, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me, Tessiana.
And Dr. Ellerin, welcome to you for your first time on Ask the Doctors.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Dr. Hirsch, I'm going to start with you in Worcester. Hospitals have been on our minds. Statewide numbers are going up. What are you seeing in your community, and what is the situation at UMass Medical and other hospitals in the Worcester area?
Yes, we're coming upon a really difficult crunch time because we were already experiencing very, very, very full hospitals, both at St. Vincent's Hospital, which is the other academic hospital in Worcester, and at UMass Medical Center, with a lot of non-COVID issues. People that had delayed care for various reasons had come in with the delayed presentations of strokes and diverticulitis and heart disease and kidney problems, and they needed a very, very long dwell time in the emergency department to even get in. And part of that is because we have a strike going on, a nurse's strike going on at St. Vincent's Hospital that has reduced the number of inpatient beds for the city. And then the Delta surge started to happen. And we reached a number last week of over 110 cases per day in the city of Worcester, which is a number we hadn't reached since January of 2021. So we're very, very concerned. It's really now a double kind of a surge of non-COVID patients and COVID patients combined.
Dr. Hirsch, when I hear you say that, so shortage of staffing, pressure on the beds even before the Delta, right, which was that surge started over the summer. Now 110 cases per day. Are you kind of in the red zone on not having enough capacity? Are we worried that we're approaching that moment?
Well, we're definitely worried. I think that our CEO here at the UMass Medical Center, Dr. Eric Dixon, has done what the recommendation was to stop elective surgeries and other procedures. And we're trying to figure out, do we have a mitigation strategy? You know, the first two surges, we had our DCU center, our local arena, had been made into a field hospital. We don't have that option now. We had a local nursing home that was converted into a convalescent place for elderly with COVID. We don't have that now. So we really have to be very strategic in how to do this moving forward. Fortunately, about a third of the new COVID cases are, the reinfection or breakthrough cases, and they're milder. And not all of those patients are requiring hospital care, and certainly not ICU care. But we are still very concerned that we are. Especially with the new variant coming into play, we're getting into dangerous territory.
1-800-423-8255. You are listening to Ask the Doctors on Radio Boston. Call with your coronavirus questions. So, Dr. Todd Ellerin, I'm going to turn to you now, and let's check in on the South Shore. You've heard the picture in the Worcester area. What are you seeing there?
Yes, Tidiana, we're also seeing rising cases of COVID in our system. I can tell you from an outpatient perspective at our Health Express, there's over a 20% positive rate for patients who come in who are having COVID testing. So 20 out of every 100 patients who are tested are coming back positive. That's an extremely high number, higher than we had in prior surges. And our number of inpatients are increasing. We've certainly seen higher peaks. But the problem here is we've seen peaks that have literally peaked within a month or two before. And right now, we're seeing a very slow and steady increase. And the concern is that we have, as we've heard from Dr. Hirsch before, we have a full house right now. So we don't have the capacity to necessarily see 150 COVID patients, which we saw at a previous peak, more than a year ago. And it is concerning because winter is still ahead of us.
So what looms in my head, and I'm going to put the number out one more time before I go to phones, 800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus questions, although I have to admit I have like 800 of them. What is looming in my head hearing the two of you? So now here's Omicron. Now, there's a lot we don't know. Last week, when we were first beginning to talk about it, we talked with an expert in modeling who said we'll be looking at transmissibility, we'll be looking at how sick people get. So far, we're hearing a lot about transmissibility. We are not hearing a lot about serious or severity of illness. But I do want to ask the two of you, one, do we know more than we did about Omicron a week ago? And two, are we worried that it layered on top of Delta could exacerbate sort of our emergency capacity? Dr. Hirsch.
Well, certainly, I think Dr. Ellerin, as an infectious disease doc, may have inner circles more up to date than me. But what I heard today on a local talk that we had with the two hospitals, infectious disease folk, is that it seems like you said, transmissibility is elevated with the Omicron Delta Omicron variant, but nobody is really sure that it's going to be strong enough to bump Delta off of its perch. The severity of the cases does not seem to be that much. But in the unvaccinated, it still is a pretty dangerous disease. So what we have found is with all the publicity about Omicron, our numbers of folk that are seeking out vaccinations, whether it's primary vaccinations, second doses, or boosters, has really gone up in the last week. We've been getting a lot of calls that there's wait lines that are long, or that the wait lists in the pharmacies are long. And maybe this will be the thing that will get us higher than we ever were as far as herd immunity. We have not been as good as the state overall, 72% total vaccination rate in the state. We're at about 60% here in Worcester County.
And Dr. Ellerin, to Dr. Hirsch's point, before I go to the phones, anything that you have heard, in your circle of infectious disease physicians about what we know now that we didn't a week ago with Omicron?
Well, first, let's back up and say, how are we doing right now treating current patients who likely have Delta? And that is, we're doing much better for the individual than we had before because of some of the therapies, some of these immune suppressive therapies where we quiet that storm that COVID can cause. And we're using monoclonal antibodies that can reduce patients who are in the outpatient setting who are ambulatory. It can reduce the likelihood of them getting hospitalized by close to 70%. These are high risk patients, of course, not just anyone who's healthy, but high risk adults and even children now. So with all of this, we have antivirals as well that we have thrown into the mix. There's no question that individual patients, even the highest risk ones, are doing better than they were doing before. So that's good news. Remember, though, when you have the most contagious variants, you're blowing and you have much greater transmission. These numbers are so much greater than even if you're reducing your mortality from, let's say, 5% down to 1%. If you have, 10 times or 20 times or 50 times greater numbers of infections, then you can still see more hospitalizations and more deaths.
Right. 5% of 100 is smaller than 0.1% of a million, right?
Right. Another way of saying is we've seen more deaths from COVID-19 in 2021 to 2020. So you can say that doesn't make sense. If you're saying the treatments are better, why aren't we seeing less deaths? And that's because the variants are so much more contagious. So the denominator is much larger. So with that said, the good news is, I think we just heard Dr. Hirsch say this with Omicron, is that in South Africa, at least, what we're hearing is that so far it does not seem to be more severe. Now, you really have to put question or quotations around that because we've only known about this variant for a few weeks. So, you know, there is more to come. But so far, even though it may be more contagious, maybe it will evade our immunity greater. Again, these are still question marks. So far, it doesn't look more virulent.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Ashley in Salem. Ashley, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am getting together with family at the end of December, and we're trying to take lots of precautions, asking family to mask for the next 2 weeks, asking them to take an antigen test before we see them, before they leave their respective states. Everyone is vaccinated, but we do have two family members who are not interested in getting boosted. They're saying they live in North Carolina that they're getting conflicting messages that they don't need to get boosted yet, even though they had their first shots in May. Are we still protected in terms of the fact that they're not willing to get boosted? I have a 4-year-old and a 4-month-old. I'm hoping that just the fact that they're vaccinated is enough.
Let's ask Dr. Hirsch here. We're on limited clock here, Dr. Hirsch. So for Ashley, family members who don't want to get boosted, they're getting conflicting messages. They are vaccinated. Are they safe?
I think that the booster is very important if they have gone 6 months since their last injection of whatever they were given. You can achieve about 98% of your immune capabilities in just 2 days after the booster. So you don't have to wait a long time after you get boosted. And it's pretty obvious to us that a lot of the breakthrough infections are in the folks that got their vaccinations very early and now have let 6 to 8 months elapse. So I would definitely tell them to get boosted if they haven't been.
Okay. And I was going to try to get to another call, but we're close enough to end of show. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. But I'm going to turn to you, Dr. Eller, and ask you about this messaging. So here we've got a community of family members. They're vaccinated. They want to get together, but now they're finding out that's not enough. They've got to get boosted. Another caller that I can't get to, Dave from West Roxbury, saying people are starting to push back and say, why should I get the vaccine? Nothing's changing. I'm still not safe to get together with my family, et cetera. So what is your message right now about where safety lies and why this is a moving target? And we have to do it briefly. I'm sorry.
Right. I mean, I agree with everything Dr. Hirsch said. Right now, fully vaccinated is not what we used to call after 2 doses of vaccine. We really want 3 doses. So if it's been 6 months since your last dose, we need a booster. That's going to reduce the likelihood of infection and reduce the likelihood of transmission. I like what Ashley's doing, asking her family members to come and get tested before, even if you're vaccinated, even if you're boosted. Again, since we don't know about Omicron and we know that Delta is very contagious, and we know that you can still get it when you're vaccinated, testing remains very important. But remember, the unvaccinated is still the population that is getting the hardest hit, most likely to get hospitalized, most likely to get into the intensive care unit, and most likely to die from COVID-19, no matter what variant.
All right.
So it is key. If you've been unvaccinated, you need to roll up your sleeve. Now is the most important time.
Dr. Todd Ellerin, Director of Infectious Diseases at South Shore Health, and Dr. Michael Hirsch, Medical Director of the Department of Public Health in Worcester. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having
us.
When we get to it, just freeze. Very good. And control your vibrato, so I don't want to hear, I want you to pull it straight, okay? Got it?
That is Trey McLaughlin and the Sounds of Zamar, a gospel music group from Augusta, Georgia. They were in town almost 2 years ago now, just before the pandemic, as part of the Celebrity Series of Boston, and we wanted to revisit that conversation today. While they were in town, McLaughlin and Sounds of Zamar stopped by WBUR Studio 3, where I'm sitting now, to talk about the gospel music tradition. And McLaughlin talked about, among other things, the importance of gospel music maintaining its connection to its religious and spiritual roots, no matter what form it takes.
I think it's paramount. I think in the end, it's called gospel music for a reason. I will say, as a style, you can do something in a gospel style and it not necessarily be a sacred text. I think that we're starting to see that a lot in popular music. I think Ray Charles did a good job of taking the gospel sound and using it with R&B music and blues. But there are they're all related, to be honest. Rhythm and blues, gospel music, they all kind of came out of the church.
So I want to do some juxtaposition that I think helps underscore what you're talking about and explore that a little bit. So this first piece, this is a 2019 song by Kanye West called Hands On.
What have you been hearing from the Christians? They'd be the first one to judge me. Make it feel like nobody loved me. They'd be the first one to judge me. Feeling like nobody loved me. Told people God was my mission.
What are you being? So then we have another song earlier in his career by Kanye West, and this one is called Jesus Walks.
And I don't think there's nothing I could do now to right my wrongs. I want to talk to God, but I'm afraid because we ain't spoken so long. God, show me the way because the devil.
Same artist.
Right.
15 years away. And is that what you mean about the difference between gospel style and gospel content?
Yes, that's definitely a part of it. While Jesus Walks definitely pushed the message more, it still didn't have a typical gospel sound, right? And then the second, the first example you played, the most recent one,
Hands On,
still didn't really have a gospel sound, but what he more so was expressing beyond the message was how he felt like the message that he was trying to push would be perceived because it was him, which still kind of is a gospel thing, because in the end, we as a people use gospel to express things that we felt were being done to us, how we were being oppressed, stuff that we felt was unfair in societal treatment. So even though technically that wasn't a sacred text, it still was kind of gospel in nature.
For some, using a faith tradition, a gospel tradition, a Christian tradition, for example, creates common ground. But sometimes people want to engage with that music and are not comfortable with that message. Is right. there a set of transcendent messages about values, morals, that can be brought through gospel music?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things I love about doing what I do with Zamar, is because it is for people of our same faith. It is for people of our same belief system, of course, but it's also for people who may not necessarily believe the same things that we believe, but who are looking for an experience or who are looking to come together, who are looking for unity. We want those people to be able to enjoy our music as well, because technically, for our faith or our belief system, we are here to engage all people.
When we were having this discussion earlier, one of the artists that we talked about was Chance the Rapper, who has been interesting in his career in crossing genres. Here's a little bit from a song called Finish Line, which is from 2016.
Get this money, get this budget, K-OK to take him. Me and my girl plan to stay to the end. Hope it never come a day where we be better as friends. We in a marathon, we could build a marathon. Arguments and spirits, they get deeper than a marathon.
Now, if I understand it, that actually segues eventually into some Kirk Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really interesting, given
right.
where. And it seems like a dialogue between men, between genres, between messages, between generations.
Yes.
It strikes me in listening to your work, in listening to some of the music that we listened to prepare for today, that dialogue is essential to what the music's about.
It's the most important thing. Community is the most important thing. That has always been the goal of music for African Americans, because that's been the goal of music for Africans. The community is there. The community is singing. It's not a performance. It is a community activity. And I think that we brought that same mentality here with us. So even as the slaves sung, they sung slave songs or work songs in the fields. It was about community. It was about unity. And sometimes they didn't even come from the same tribes. They didn't even speak the same languages. You know, music is transcendent. And I think community has always been the goal, even before we knew the sacred text.
You were here at a City Space event downstairs
yeah.
recently, and one of the people in the audience during the Q&A asked you if you would engage with a choir that was sitting in the audience in what's called call and response.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is.
I laid awake at night. And that's alright. I know that Jesus. I know that Jesus.
So just before you started the call and response, the questioner asked you, and you turned to the choir and said, "Do you know Trouble in My Way?" And some people look like maybe they didn't know it. And you're like, how can you not know Trouble in My Way? But then you guys just kind of did it. It was a dialogue that was just an invitation to figure it out together.
Yeah.
And so much of the rest of the audience, if you watch that audience carefully, wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
But they don't know how. Right? You see people kind of scooching in their seats and they're wondering if they should sing along and they're not really sure if they should clap. What holds us back with such a beautiful invitation?
I will tell you, I think Western music tradition holds us back. And not that there's anything wrong with it. There's not. Classical Western music tradition is of performance and audience. And typically the audience does not join in the performance. They only experience it.
What do we lose?
We lose an opportunity to create community. Because what happens is, while we're all having the collective experience together, I think to actually join in and not just watch it transcends us. It takes us to another place. I think it's another level of connection.
So your group, Sounds of Zamar, is here. Can you tell us about the group and introduce us to everyone?
Yeah. So when I graduated from college and decided that I didn't want to be an opera singer, I started to get invitations to churches and events to come sing. I'm actually very shy, so I asked my friends to come with me. And then I started to teach them my own arrangements. And so from there, we kind of started a group.
And you're going to perform for us today?
Yes.
What are you going to perform?
We're going to do a cover from The Lion King called He Lives in You.
Fantastic.
One, two, ready?
Wait. Ella. Ella. Mama Mella. He lives in you.
Oh, he lives in me.
He lives in me.
That is Trey McLaughlin with his group, Sounds of Zamar. They were here in Studio 3 here back in February of 2020. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.